Coming up on the program today, playing public policy favorites, some trade by truck, and the long, slow death of the power suit. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is good to have you along, everybody. Wednesday today, the 10th day of January. So look, here is an interesting way to do public policy. Look at a break that somebody else got and say, hey, what about me? The Trump administration has now decided it is not going to allow oil drilling off the coast of Florida after all that, after pressure from Republican Governor Rick Scott. So today, South Carolina's Republican Governor Henry McMaster said, hey, what about me? Marketplace's Amy Scott reports now from Maryland, where another Republican governor is saying, hey, what about me? Citing drilling's threats to established industries like tourism and commercial fishing as well.
It's quiet on the shore of the Chesapeake Bay near Annapolis on this winter day. Some ducks bob in the icy water. A laughing gull passes overhead. But the calm is deceptive.
Economists have valued the Chesapeake Bay at about $120 billion annually. This is an economic engine for the region.
Will Baker is president of the Chesapeake Bay Foundation. The nonprofit's mission is to clean up the bay from decades of industrial and agricultural pollution. Baker says the blue crab fishery alone is worth up to $500 million a year.
One ill-timed oil spill in that area could wipe out an entire year class of the Chesapeake Bay's number one fishery.
The Trump administration says the current restrictions on offshore drilling have cost the country billions of dollars and thousands of jobs. But Diane Hoskins with the conservation group Oceana says the proposal threatens other industries.
The plan, as proposed, puts the oil and gas industry interests ahead of coastal tourism, commercial, recreational fishing industries.
Further south in Virginia Beach, Virginia, Chris Ludford makes his living farming oysters and giving eco-tours. Ludford is old enough to remember the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill.
Like Alaska, we have a lot of tourism. We have a lot of recreational fishing, charter fishing. We have seafood production.
And those businesses, he says, are producing jobs and paying taxes now. The size of potential oil and gas reserves is still unknown. That's a big gamble, Ludford says.
And also a big gamble to continue an addiction that we need to work on freeing ourselves from. You know, hitting the easy button and finding more fossil fuel just prolongs our addiction.
President Trump has also proposed rolling back safety measures put in place after the 2010 Deepwater Horizon disaster in the Gulf Coast. Tim Charters is with the National Ocean Industries Association. It represents the offshore oil, natural gas, and wind sectors. Charters says the industry is working hard to prevent spills, and he says the United States is a long way from weaning itself from oil.
The Energy Information Agency says that by 2040, we're still going to be 77% dependent on fossil fuels. And so we need energy security in the United States. And, you know, we really need it all.
A two-month public comment period started this week. Maryland's governor, Republican Larry Hogan, has asked the state's attorney general to investigate a lawsuit blocking any drilling here. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
You've perhaps seen that bit of the televised negotiating session yesterday congressional leaders had with President Trump. Immigration was the headline news out of it. But the president said something else that hasn't gotten quite the commensurate amount of attention. That maybe what we need to do, the president said, in this economy is bring back earmarks. That's the system basically banned by the GOP back in 2010 that let members of Congress direct money specifically toward their pet projects. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reminds us why earmarks went away in the first place and why there is whispering now about bringing them back.
The president's argument is basically that back in the day, earmarks helped grease the wheels of government.
But maybe all of you should start thinking about going back to a form of earmarks because this system...
John Hudak at the Brookings Institution says congressional earmarks don't deserve the bad rap. Yes, there were a few of those bridge-to-nowhere type projects funded this way, but earmarks were only ever a tiny portion of government spending and mostly went to useful projects.
What a lot of people don't understand, however, is that if Congress chooses not to divide up the federal budget, the executive branch will.
Government agencies now have much more discretion over how and where money is spent. And he says earmarks do still exist. They're just not called that anymore. For example, says Ryan Alexander of Taxpayers for Common Sense, a member of Congress might call a program administrator on the phone and say,
you know, I want to make sure you know about how great this one program is and that fits within your guidelines and you should fund it. And by the way, I'm on the oversight committee for your program.
But she says the earmark crackdown has helped reduce the practice. And, says Alexander, it's worth remembering why they were banned in the first place.
The big problem with earmarks is that it put political muscle above project merit.
And that, she says, is not worth reviving, even if it made deal-making a little easier. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Among the most anxious people in economic policy right now, people running the budgets in more wealthy, generally high-tax, and often Democratic-leaning states. Remember the limits to state and local tax deductions in the new tax law? That's money going to the feds that is not going to the states. So now California, New York, New Jersey, among others, are tossing around ideas for how to get some of their own money back. Marketplace's Ryan Kailath has that one.
The idea that New Jersey and California are both exploring involves in-state charitable donations to offset state taxes. Daniel Hemmel of the University of Chicago Law School explains.
California says, hey, if you want to give to your local public hospital or to your local fire department, we'll give you a tax benefit, a credit against state taxes due.
So when the federal government takes its cut, there's less income visible for it to tax. Jared Walczak of the Tax Foundation says the IRS sees right through this.
The IRS usually doesn't look very favorably on gimmicks like that, and it certainly doesn't have charitable intent.
The IRS could block the states from doing this, but David Kamen of NYU Law says a 2011 IRS memo affirms the right of other states to do something similar. Many conservative states use exactly this trick to fund vouchers for private religious schools.
And the IRS has so far said you can get a charitable deduction for that.
So changing the rules for California and New Jersey might kill tax-diverting programs in states like Alabama, too. New York has a different approach. Governor Andrew Cuomo wants to swap the income tax for a payroll tax, which is still fully deductible at the federal level. Lawyers say that approach has slightly more legal standing. So even though the tax bill is law now, it's kicked off a new political showdown, one between states and the federal government. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
Wall Street today? Hey, look, it's still a bond market story. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. First things first, as I set up this next story, despite his known fondness for Cherry Coke and Oreos, Warren Buffett is fine. 87 years old and going strong. Also, he says not going anywhere, which I mention because this morning Buffett's holding company Berkshire Hathaway promoted two of its executives and put them on the board of directors, instantly making them front runners to succeed Buffett. You know, when? Ajit Jain and Greg Abel are their names, and Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports that Berkshire is getting points and props for doing succession right.
It's no accident that Berkshire Hathaway is making it fairly obvious that these two gentlemen figure into its succession plan.
They really are showing the world that they have succession in place.
Jeannie Brantover is with DHR International and specializes in succession planning. Finding a good replacement for your CEO is important, obviously, but Brantover says so is letting people know that you have a plan.
It stops a lot of gossip. It stops a lot of chatter. It stops stock from being sold. Succession or lack of succession can affect revenue, credibility, clientele.
A good succession plan, she says, starts well before a CEO reaches retirement age. It's something companies should evaluate every year.
You're always thinking about who are the next two or three generations of leaders.
Nels Olson is with Korn Ferry, an executive search firm. Berkshire Hathaway is looking to two executives who've been with the company for a combined 50 years. This is what 78% of companies do, look for and groom internal candidates.
Looking internally is always best because those individuals know the company, know the culture, know the strategy.
Even when companies do bring people in from the outside, they try to bring them in below the CEO to basically try them out and get them up to speed. Steve Odland is CEO of the Committee for Economic Development.
It's a little like merging onto a freeway. You've got to merge onto the highway without creating an accident.
And accidents do happen. CEOs have run companies into the ground as well as taken them to new heights. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace. Here's a seemingly random economic statistic that A is going to make a whole lot of sense once you hear it, but also B is a sore spot in the NAFTA negotiations that are going on. More than 70% of the goods traded between the United States and Mexico is shipped by trucks. Makes sense, right? But who gets to drive those trucks is the issue. Natalie Kitchoff writes about it in the New York Times. Natalie, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
This is in a lot of ways, the tale of two truckers, this story is. One who brings it 24 miles into the States and the other who gets to take it the rest of the way. What are the rules? How did we get here?
So when the U.S. signed NAFTA in 1993, it agreed to let Mexicans eventually deliver goods wherever they wanted in the country. But the union representing the truckers in America, the Teamsters, revolted, pressured the White House. So for 20 years, that was put on hold, and Mexicans weren't allowed to do that. In 2015, Barack Obama reversed that moratorium and allowed Mexicans to come in. But, you know, what developed over these 20 years is this handoff that you just described.
You went to Nuevo Laredo on the other side of the border. Tell us what you found there, what you saw. And that's the sort of the embarkation point, I suppose, for a lot of these truckers.
Right. So American companies hire trucking companies that are based out of Nuevo Laredo, which is just across the border from Laredo, Texas, to bring the goods sort of on this short route right across the border. And what you find there are Mexican drivers who, you know, for them, NAFTA has opened this brand new career path. You know, trucking pays a lot better than a lot of the occupations down there. Now, on the other hand, if you compare what the Mexican drivers earn and how much they work to what the Americans are doing, and look, American truckers work long, hard hours, and we know how hard that job is. But the Mexicans, they get the driver that I talked to, Raul Miranda, he got about $12 every time he crossed. And he worked up to, you know, on the really bad days, 18 hours. So it's a tough job.
And he drives that same route four or five times. I mean, he picks something up in Nuevo Laredo, drives it 20-ish miles into the country, turns around and comes home, right?
Right. So you can imagine this guy's dream is to drive past Laredo, Texas. You know, he goes across the border, he comes back to Mexico. He goes across the border, he comes back to Mexico, earning $12 each time. And the idea of making deliveries in the middle of the U.S., in the heartland, I mean, he couldn't think of anything better.
Right. And that's the flip side of the coin, right? There's a whole set of American truckers, well, American truckers, full stop, who pick up these goods at the drop-off point and then drive them out into the rest of the American economy.
That's right. And, you know, there's 30,000 American truckers who handle NAFTA goods, and that includes the goods that come from the U.S. and Canada. But yes, I mean, trucking has become famously this occupation that has had a shortage of drivers, the companies have said. You know, as this trade has exploded, you know, we talk about the opportunities in Mexico, and there's a lot of debate over NAFTA right now. But if you talk to truckers, it has meant a lot of new business for them.
Where has the Trump administration come down on this whole issue?
Right. So this is kind of interesting. I mean, Republican administrations haven't usually backed labor in discussions over trade, but the Trump administration seems to be bringing an America First agenda to the bargaining table at NAFTA, and they are proposing a provision that could eventually in the future, you know, severely limiting the access of Mexican truckers. You know, what I think is actually even kind of more interesting is that if you talk to people on the ground, it actually seems like the market, more than the written trade rules, is what's keeping Mexicans out of the country.
Explain that a little bit.
it's really expensive for Mexican truckers to make deliveries in the U.S. Insurance costs more for Mexican drivers. That's just because insurance costs more for any driver without a proven track record. Yeah. And more to the point, because we buy more from Mexican companies than we sell to them, what often happens is that when Mexican truckers get to the United States, get to a warehouse or to a retailer, they don't have a trailer to bring back. And much like a foreign airline, they can't go between locations in the United States. They can kind of go to Wisconsin and come back, go back to Mexico. So if they don't have a trailer to bring back with them, there's probably not a shipper paying for that route, which means that it's it ends up being pretty expensive to hire them to do that job.
Yeah. Natalie Kitroff, writing in the New York Times the other day, a fascinating piece about trucking across the U.S.-Mexican border. Natalie, thanks a lot.
It's always good to be here.
Coming up.
And now it's really just a matter of ease and comfort.
Staying comfortable at the office. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gave back just under a 10% today, 16 points, 25,369 for the blue chips. NASDAQ reversed about a 10%, 11 points, 71.53. S&P 500 also down a 10th, 3 points, wrapped up at 27.48. One reason? Bonds, as we said yesterday, the prospect of rising yields could be taking some gas out of equities. Prospect of rising interest rates did, however, raise interest in financial stocks. J.P. Morgan Chase deposited a 10th percent. Morgan Stanley added about 1.1%. As we told you, Warren Buffett promoted two executives likely to take the top rungs of the ladder at Berkshire Hathaway. Someday, Buffett, as we said, in no hurry. Berkshire stock up 1%, $308,350 apiece. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. With Brexit negotiations grinding toward the March 2019 deadline for Britain to extract itself from the European Union, there is a dawning realization over in the UK that there will be repercussions to the separation beyond just economic. Turns out, as just one example, that British cities aren't going to be able to participate in something called the European Capitals of Culture program. It's a PR thing, yes, but the winning city does get a little bit of cash and often a big influx of tourists and investment. The idea of being shut out of that contest, then, is a bitter pill for the five British cities in the mix for the next title. Marketplace's Stephen Beard went to one of them, the town of Milton Keynes, northwest of London.
This town is thriving economically, but it's not the most obvious candidate for the title of European Capital of Culture. It was built in the 1960s to relieve the overcrowding in London. Florence or Venice, it ain't.
You've never seen anywhere like it. Central Milton Keynes.
A rather jaunty TV commercial battling against the town's image as dull, bland and featureless, a sterile concrete dormitory. Its only real claim to fame, it has more roundabouts or traffic circles than anywhere else. Even the head of the local tourist organisation, Anne Lim, can't resist ruefully retelling an old joke.
What's the difference between Milton Keynes and a pot of yogurt? The answer is the pot of yogurt has culture.
So why would Milton Keynes even enter a competition to become a European Capital of Culture? That is obvious, says leader of the City Council, Pete Marland.
We think that it would have brought in upwards of £200 to £300 million in the period between now and 2023. It would have really boosted the economy.
Liverpool reckons that after it won the title in 2008, it made more than $1 billion, thanks to the big increase in visitors, hotel bookings, restaurant profits and even inward investment. Marland is more than a little ticked off that British cities are now banned from even bidding for the title.
Am I allowed to say I'm pretty pissed? Because I am. I'm really annoyed.
But can a British city really be considered a European capital of culture after Brexit? Tourism chief Anne Lim.
Hang on. You know, we are still part of Europe. We're leaving the European Union because of this decision on Brexit. But we're part of Europe. We have relationships with Europe. We think in a European way.
And she says, think again about Milton Keynes' reputation. In reality, this town has plenty of culture. It has this world-class orchestra and a very successful theatre, and in spite of all the concrete around here, the surrounding villages are steeped in history.
Amazing Grace.
The words of Amazing Grace were composed by a local clergyman. A local museum tells his story. And not far from the centre of Milton Keynes, there's a fascinating slice of more recent history, as told in many feature films and documentaries.
September 1939. As Britain declared war on Nazi Germany, an extraordinary ragtag army was being assembled at Bletchley Park in Buckinghamshire.
The codebreakers at Bletchley Park cracked Germany's Enigma code and, says local businessman John Cove, played a vital role in the defeat of Hitler.
Bletchley, which is part of Milton Keynes, was a place where essentially the war was won.
Which, he says, further underlines the city's credentials as a European capital of culture. He too deplores the EU ban, but concedes the city has benefited from the resulting publicity.
There's opportunity for us to be shouting about ourselves, what's good about Milton Keynes, what's different, for people not only to come and visit, but to invest, to move here, to live here.
The city is already home to more than 3,000 manufacturing and service companies. It's a centre of technical innovation. This summer it'll become the first European city to launch a public taxi service using self-driving cars. Some already call it Capital of the Future. Not a bad consolation title, and one from which nobody can disqualify it. In Milton Keynes, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
There is a certain beauty to working outside the Washington, New York, maybe all the way up to Boston corridor, a beauty that lets people, men specifically here, not have to wear suits and ties to work every day. Robin Givhan writes on fashion, most recently men's suits for the Washington Post. Thanks for coming on.
It's a pleasure to be here.
The headline on this piece is a history of the final dying days of the power suit. I have to confess that I'm surprised to hear the power suit is still alive.
Well, you clearly are not in the nation's capital.
Well, yeah.
I think that if you turn on C-SPAN, for instance, you will, see a great panoply of congressmen wearing the traditional business suit and very traditional in terms of the cut and the color.
Yeah, well, and so much so, and you say this in the piece, right, that it's become a uniform. You put a white shirt on, a red or a blue tie, and a darkish suit, and boom, you're done.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a point at which, the suit had this symbolism that the most powerful man in the room was going to be the one in the suit, and there was this sort of competition with power ties and suspenders and all of that. And now it's really just a matter of ease and comfort and, to some degree, camouflage.
This is going to sound funny coming from a guy who, being in radio, I could be wearing pajamas for all anybody knows. And maybe I am. Do you lament sort of casual Fridays and what that has wrought?
You know, I don't lament casual Fridays. I lament sloppiness.
Yeah.
But I do think that the shift away from the suit as the sole way to demonstrate or show your power and authority, you know, is a good thing. Because I think it gives men certainly more options. And I also think it kind of levels the playing field a bit because women never had that kind of reliable standard uniform that immediately conveyed power. So I think it makes it a little bit easier for people to have a wider sense of what power looks like.
A nod here, then, to millennials. Is that a factor in the demise, as you write, of the power suit?
You know, I think it's the millennials have both killed the power suit and they've also elevated the suit as a fashion statement. Huh. Millennials are much more likely to use a suit as something that they would slip on going out and socializing, as opposed to something that they are going to go into a store searching for because they need a closet full of, you know, sort of bland navy suits.
Right. Robin Givhan writes on fashion for The Washington Post. Robin, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, another episode of Market Blockchase Block. Oh, man, I blew the joke. Market Blockchain Place coming to a close. Remember I told you yesterday how Kodak said it's going to get into blockchain technology and traders promptly sent its shares up 119%, the latest entry into the cryptocurrency bubble? Yeah, well, guess what? They are still buying. KODK is the ticker symbol. Shares up another 57% today. You know what's not a bubble? Riz dollars. That's what. All right, we got to go. The percentage of the day today on Wall Street was a 10th percent. The Dow off a 10th percent, 16 points. NASDAQ off a 10th percent, 11 points. S&P 500, 10th percent, 3 points. Sarah Bruguer, Jake Gorski, Drew Josta, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.